from the Carter Subaru Studios. This is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Voitin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? G is off today. Jack Stein from Cairo Knights is in once again this morning. Jack, what did you do with the sun?
Oh, man, everything. Everything that I could possibly do. I did yoga. I walked my little Pomeranian. I didn't get into any fights. It was great.
Yeah. I am proud of you, but something has happened. The temperature has dropped by 20 degrees, and suddenly I feel like we're back into, January? Please don't tell me that summer's over. I didn't want to complain that much.
It.
I know. No, we got lots more sun coming up, but we'll have to wait a couple of days. Coming up in the show, about a third of the school's teachers in the state's largest school district say they plan to leave their jobs in the next 5 years. What is going on there? We'll talk about that. And then later in the show, did some of Seattle's homeless move to the suburbs? One King County Council member is complaining about that. Hannah Scott's going to fill us in during our 10 o'clock hour. We do have a packed show. As always, we want to hear from you. 888-973-5476 is our state roofing text line. And let's get right with it into our top stories of the day, brought to you by Economy Fence Center. Former President Trump is now reacting to those bombshell revelations by a former White House aide after Cassidy Hutchinson's explosive testimony yesterday. Trump dismissed her, saying he hardly knows who she is, called her a total phony. But even some of Trump's staunchest supporters say Hutchinson is a credible witness and her testimony was extremely damaging. Mick Mulvaney was former acting White House chief of staff during the Trump administration.
She testified that he knew that there were guns on property and that he still encouraged people to go down to the Capitol. That certainly changes my mind. Whether or not it's going to change the hardcore MAGA supporters on the right wing of the party, I don't know. That remains to be seen.
So let's go over some of the biggest takeaways from Hutchinson's testimony, because it happened during our show and we tried to take some of it live, but we missed some of it. So she had testified that members of Trump's inner circle were concerned about violence on January 6th, long before that date arrived. And she said that they had grown increasingly alarmed for good reason. On the morning of the rally, Trump supporters were spotted on the perimeter of the area with AR-15s, bear spray, flagpoles that had also been fashioned into spears, along with other weapons. And even though then President Trump was informed that his supporters were armed, she said that he wanted them along for the ride.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
The mags she refers to are magnetometers. These are the metal detectors that are set up at the entrances of the rally to detect weapons. She also detailed a conversation between White House counsel Pat Cipollone and her boss, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, about the president's reaction to his crowd threatening to hang the vice president.
I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the vice president to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. To which Pat said something, this is effing crazy.
And, of course, you recall that about that time, President Trump sent out a tweet ripping Pence for lacking the courage to do what needs to be done. And one of the other new allegations, Jack, that she made is that Trump was adamant about driving to the Capitol while the attack was underway because he had promised his supporters at the earlier rally that he would be there. And she described a conversation that she had with Tony Ornato, a Secret Service agent who served as Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations. And she said that Ornato had told her the president was outraged when he was told that he could not go to the Capitol.
The president had very strong, a very angry response to that. Tony described him as being irate. The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm.
said, sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol. Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
So Bobby Engel was the head of the Secret Service under President Trump. And now this morning, sources are telling CBS News that both of them are prepared to testify under oath that neither of them were physically attacked by Trump and that he never actually lunged for the steering wheel. But they don't dispute that he was irate or that he demanded that he be taken to the Capitol at that moment. So, again, we took some of the hearing live. We discussed it as much as we could yesterday. But now that you've had a chance to see and hear all of it, what are your thoughts?
I think it's so fascinating, Ursula, like the amount of like everybody turns into a junior detective, right? When somebody or like a junior lawyer every time something like this comes out. And they scrutinize and they analyze, and I've seen pictures of the limousine that Trump normally was trafficked around in. I've seen people say, well, he's a 72-year-old man. How could he possibly have reached over and grabbed the steering wheel or grabbed for somebody's neck or something like that? I think what's possible is that he wasn't in the presidential limousine. He could have been in one of the Secret Service SUVs. He could have very possibly, like, gestured over somebody's shoulder and said, take me back to my people or whatever it is. And then when the gentleman was retelling the story to Cassidy Hutchinson, he could have been in the moment trying to embellish the story to her. I think that's all entirely feasible. And yet people are using this as a, I don't know. They're kind of treating it like it's a joke in a really weird way, right?
So when you say they're people, they're treating it as like who's treating it as a joke? Because for the first time, I actually heard people taking it much more seriously yesterday. Even people who are normally staunch Trump supporters were like,
right.
Whoa, wait. This might be much more serious. And again, the conversation that she had with Tony Renato, it might have been that he had embellished it, or you know, it could be that she embellished it. But again, she's under oath, so we have to wait now to hear who else is going to be testifying under oath about what exactly had transpired when he was in the SUV. I think it's established that he was in the SUV, and but I don't even since that is in dispute. Yes, he was irate, whether some of the lunging or whatever else happened, I think that's in dispute. But the fact that he knew that there were weapons, but it didn't matter to him because those people were not going to attack him.
Right. And we know for a fact that these guys and gals were using bear spray against Capitol Police officers. There's loads of footage of it. We know for a fact that they were using their American flags as spears. There's loads of footage of it. And we know for a fact that there were guns at the Capitol because there's loads of footage of it. There's actually one piece of footage that for some reason every single political commentator decides to skip over if they're on the conservative side, where a gentleman has his concealed carry fall out of its holster. And then people start going, gun, 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 gun. And then one of his friends comes over and picks it up and hands it back to him. You can find that on YouTube right now. So for all the people out there that try to diminish January 6th, I think it's because largely Ursula, I'm talking about political commentators in particular. Mm-hmm. I think it's, and also just maybe just regular individuals, they have such a hard time grappling with the idea that a group of ne'er-do-wells and potentially fascists attempted to take over the United States houses in a desperate attempt to secure the election for themselves. They have such a difficult time processing that it's much easier to just dismiss it outright and say, January 6th, the worst day in America. Be sarcastic, mm-hmm. Be sardonic, not cover the entirety of the news, right? It's very, very easy to do that as a commentator and also as a listener, much to people's detriment, because it makes them sound ignorant, right? To say, oh, well, there were no guns there. There's footage of people with firearms at the Capitol. You could look it up right now. Well, there was no bear spray. Go look at the guys who are trying to get into the rotunda. What are they doing? They are spraying Capitol Police officers with bear spray. Well, there weren't any spears there. I don't know. Chef, you've seen the footage of those guys.
No, we've seen this. Yes. We've all seen
literally stabbing Capitol police officers with American flags. What? I don't understand. Like, people say that people like you and I, Ursula, are living in like some weird fantasy realm. When they themselves are ignoring this mountain of evidence. Right.
And the whole thing is, and I said this yesterday, I'm going to say it again, it shouldn't be about politics and what party that you, you know, believe that you belong to. This should be of deep concern to everybody because how it is described is like, it sounds like it was an attempted coup. I mean, this is stuff that happens. I was born and raised in the Philippines for part of my life. These are things that you might expect in other places, but the United States of America, where now a former president knew that there were people who were armed, but because he didn't think it was going to be any kind of attack toward him, he was okay with that. Even in Washington, D.C., security is extremely high. So the idea that people could be walking around with these weapons and then getting into the Capitol, I mean, it's to try to stop an election. It's a mind boggle. And this idea that some try to dismiss this as just merely a witch hunt or say that no one cares or this is not newsworthy. It's easy to just dismiss it because you want to continue to pander to this base that obviously right now there are issues. Here's my question for you is, do you think that this is going to have any impact in terms of 2024 with some of President Trump's base?
Not
or do you think there's just going to have zero effect?
I think that – so there was a poll that came out, NBC poll that came out recently that I think it was last month, and it showed that it was comparing when Trump was in office versus him being out of office for about a year. And at the time, it was something like 50% of people polled said that they were more loyal to Donald Trump than they were to the party. And I think the sample base was something like 3,000 people. And then they did another one, same group of 3,000 people, and they found that only 36% of people were more loyal to Trump than they were to the party. So I think that you're never going to get the base away from Trump because they love the guy. But there are people out there, I think the more that you introduce information to them, if they're of sound mind and if they're a reasonable person, they might think twice about it.
Yeah.
All the evidence that's coming out.
Listen to former White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney again. Now, he was supporting Trump for 2024, but he says this testimony from yesterday has changed his mind.
Count me amongst one of the Republicans that hopes he's not the nominee at this point.
And you know who I'm thinking is feeling really good is Ron DeSantis. Because, I mean, a lot of people are saying, well, what's the end game for this particular select committee? I mean, it'll be interesting to see who else is going to testify. I think Mark Meadows has to testify, but is he? Check this out. I mean, this is another crazy revelation from yesterday's hearing, and this involves the former National Security Advisor, General Mike Flynn. And so you're going to hear Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who's vice chair of the select committee. She was asking the general a couple of questions that seemed like they should have been no-brainers.
General Flynn, do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified?
Can we have a minute?
Yes.
Okay, so his attorney asked for a minute before he would give an answer. They actually paused for a full minute and a half before Liz Cheney was asked to repeat the question.
Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified morally?
Take the fifth.
Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified legally?
Fifth.
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America?
Okay, that is a general being asked something as simple as, do you believe that there should be a peaceful transfer of power?
I think we can stop calling him a general now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Has he
lost his mind?
Yeah, I think he's deeply mentally ill, particularly when there's that piece of footage of him with his family taking the QAnon pledge at a little barbecue. And then like 2 weeks later, he's interviewed by, I think it was, some local station, and they go, hey, that piece of footage of you, you know, swearing your allegiance to the Q movement is out there. And he goes, I've never heard of such a thing. This is like deep mental illness from Michael Flynn. And I would go as far as to say this. I think that it is an indicator of cowardice to be unable to stand by your principles. If he really doesn't believe in the peaceful transfer of power, he should just say it. He should just say, I am a fascist, and I fundamentally believe that violence, political violence is perfectly acceptable if I don't get my desired outcome. I mean, stand by your principles is all I would ask for anybody, not to hide behind the Fifth Amendment because you're worried about prosecution.
So my question for you is, what do you think should be next? Do you think that the Justice Department is going to be looking at potential charges against the former president?
At this point, I would like to see them. Do I hope for them? In a way, yes, because I do think that Trump needs to be held to account at a certain level. Again, Ursula, you know, I say this a lot, but my biggest fear right now in the United States is kind of the rising fascist menace. And the direction that I see that coming from largely is the MAGA base, right? And I just got to add this caveat. I begged people not to vote for Joe Biden at the time. I begged people to not vote for Joe Biden. And then we see what happened after the election from, you know, November 3rd, 4th, all the way to January 6th. And you have to say to yourself, like, do you want to live in fascist America with an individual who attempted to threaten political figures and political leaders so that they would sway the election in his favor based on nothing, no evidence whatsoever. So,
and I would hope that everyone's answer is no. And again, you can think that Joe Biden is the worst president ever. If you think he's the worst president ever, okay, and you know what? That's fine. I mean, I would argue differently. I think that there are a lot of big problems in this country right now. Some of them inflicted by Joe Biden, but some of them he inherited. That all said, you can still think that Joe Biden is the worst president, but you could also say, you know what? What President Trump did was horrible. We should never have another episode like that in our nation's history. This beautiful nation should not be okay with what happened there that day.
Agreed.
Okay, still ahead, we're going to talk about this new survey that says about a third of the school teachers in the state's largest school district say they plan to leave their jobs. What's that all about? That's coming up next on the G and Ursula Show. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. I believe he's going to be back tomorrow. You know that he just got married and he and his new wife are in Florida. Jack Stein from Cairo Nights is with me this morning. And I am a big, big supporter of teachers. And I haven't had a chance to talk to you about teachers, but I found this survey very interesting. And to be clear, it is from the teachers union. But about a third of the teachers in the Seattle School District are apparently planning to leave their jobs in the next 5 years. The Seattle Education Association says the survey shows 12% of the educators plan to leave the profession entirely. Many others just say they're planning to leave the district. More than three-fourths of the survey's participants claim they're not getting enough support from the district or from their own superintendent. About 10% claim that they are working double-digit hours of overtime every week. And the district was asked for a statement, and they said that the district or Seattle Public Schools values the hard work of its staff, but they're going to refrain from any comment on this particular survey done by the union, pointing out that they're about to start negotiating the new contract for the next school year. And so my question to all of you listening right now and to you, Jack, is being a teacher still a desirable job?
I don't think so. I don't think I think it's a very honorable profession. I just don't think anybody wants to do it anymore because of the just all of the intense work that goes into it. I mean, if you're one teacher and you've got a teacher's aide, maybe, and then you've got 30 to 40 kids that you have to rein in. I mean, I don't even know how that's possible. Like when I was a kid, Ursula, I went to an elementary school where the max classroom size was 20 kids, but most often it was about 15 kids.
That's really, was it a public school?
Is a public school.
Wow.
Very well-funded district.
Mm.
There were teachers and generally like two teachers' aides per class. And so now what I think you have is post-COVID, you have a bunch of teachers who are not trained or prepared to deal with children who have effectively been isolated from a community for the better part of 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of position does that put them in? Because they're not trained to deal with kids who have effectively been traumatized through isolation treatment. You know, what do you do at that point in time?
A great question. And I actually want to bring Chef into the conversation because, Chef, your wife is a teacher.
Well, she's not a teacher. She's a behavior
That's right.
Analyst.
Okay.
So
she works in the district.
She works for a school district, yes, with the kids who have the most challenging behaviors. Jack, you're referencing the children that have a lot of issues learning. I mean, this goes back to the change in the Americans with Disabilities Act, required schools to educate students regardless of whether they would fit into a general education population. And that has proved very challenging for schools over the last 20 years or so, and the pandemic has made that worse. Couple that with the fact that politics and the politics of COVID has seeped into every classroom, that teachers are now being targeted as groomers, that the education that they are providing their children is being called into question under the guise of parental choice across the board. And I think a lot of teachers feel that they are unsupported by administration. They are the target of the public at large, or at least, you know, maybe what, 20% of the parents in the classroom aren't happy with what's happening there. And so they're between a rock and a hard place. And it's a very difficult position to be in when you feel like you're attacked by the public and you don't have the support from administration or the resources that you need to do your job. You know, if you see a train that's about to crash and you had the ability to do so, you would stop it. But you're watching train wrecks happen all the time in classrooms. And what do you do in that position? It's very defeating to know I can't change this for everyone. I just have to do the best that I can every day. It's very similar to the burnout, I think, that a lot of doctors and nurses and those working in hospitals faced over the last couple of years.
You nailed it. I had a conversation with a longtime teacher in the Seattle School District. She's an elementary school teacher in South Seattle. And she said, this past year was the hardest year that she's ever had. And she said she described how you talked about, Chef, that because of changes that she is dealing with many more children who have either behavioral problems or delays, and they're trying to integrate more of those kids into classrooms, which, you know, for many people say, hey, that's great, but the teachers aren't getting support. They're lucky if they have one aide. And in many cases, she says, and I believe she's like a first grade teacher, and she says, even at that age, you need more one-on-one versus you can't have one teacher who's trying to teach, you know, all these different kids at very different levels, plus kids who need a lot of one-on-one help trying to do that on your own. On top of that, she said she has never seen more kids getting into first grade who are still not potty trained.
Mm.
She said that so she has had
first
to have
grade.
She's had to have conversations with parents about, your kid needs to be potty trained.
Wow.
And I think that because, you know, there was a lot of, you know, again, and she's in a part of the district that I think that there are a lot of families with challenges, maybe single parent families, that kind of thing, lower income, more immigrant families. And she said that she's just never seen it. She said this was the first time she considered retiring early. But you also nailed it, Chef, when you talked about how there's also this feeling like they're expected to do everything and yet get a lot of criticism for it. And it reminds me of what police officers deal with.
Yes.
It's exactly the same thing. It's like, we want you to fix everything. We're going to let you take care of our kids for this amount of time, but we think you suck still. I mean, right? I mean, who wants to do that job?
Can I mention something about funding really quick? I had a so I can interpret in American Sign Language. Both of my parents are deaf, and
wow.
So I'm very fluent in sign language. And I got a phone call from a friend of mine who's an interpreter who said there's a local school district and they need an interpreter. This is 5-6 years ago, And she says, I think that you should apply for the position. It's one kid, and I think you'd be, you know, really great working with this kid. I said, okay, fine. I go down to the school district, and I'm talking to them, and they say, they look at my credentials, and they say, oh, you'd be so great for this child. So we would need you here 7.5 hours out of the day. And I go, okay, great. Now, normally what you do is there is an interpreter A and interpreter B, and about every 30 minutes you flip back and forth because your hands get really tired or they can cramp up and things like that. And they said, it's just going to be you. And I go, okay. And so I'm doing the math in my head where normally I would charge about $65 to $75 an hour to do that. I'm doing the math in my head. I say, okay, so if it's only going to be me, then that's going to be $125 an hour. That's my base rate. And they go, and we're willing to pay you $17.50 an hour to do this job. And I was like, I can't do that. Because I would make in a single hour interpreting for somebody else at a medical appointment what I would make in a day working for the school district. And I said, I'm sorry, I just can't take the position.
With less headache.
A couple days later, they called me and they said, we really need you on the team. What if we gave you $18 an hour? And I said, I said, I want to be able to help you, but I can't take this contract. It's just not fair to me, and it's not fair to the student as well. So,
can I give a quick shout out to the paraeducators out there who do work with some of our highest need children, and they are paid the least in the school district. So sometimes $22-23 an hour. That is a very difficult job. You do amazing work. You are very appreciated, and you should be compensated fairly.
Absolutely. And I just also want to do a shout out to teachers. I think it should still be a desirable job. It is one of the most important jobs that we have in society. And I hope that we can continue to attract and retain great teachers because we need them. Okay, still ahead. Are you having trouble navigating the changing pronouns? We're going to find out why one company's pronoun policy is driving some employees away. This is the G and Ursula Show with Jack Stein. Thank you so much for hanging out with us on the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. Jack Stein is in with me. And here's a question for all of you. How important do you think pronouns are? So in case you missed it, last week, the Biden administration boosted Title IX boosting protections for transgender college students. And these new rules bar all forms of sex discrimination, including discrimination based on sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, pregnancy or related conditions, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And so that essentially means that any school that gets federal funding is going to be required to allow trans students to use bathrooms that match their gender identity and to be addressed by their pronouns. So is this all about just being woke, or does this actually matter, Jack?
I think it matters. I think it matters a lot for little trans kids. I think the resistance that people have to this largely comes from like the deluge or the fire hose of anti-trans propaganda that gets pumped out on a daily basis by conservative circles.
Can I just and hug so, you for right now? Just
I know. And so the problem is that people don't recognize that, like, children suffer from dysphoria. Now, something like 60 to 75% of those kids tend to age out of it. 25% of them do not. And so what has been shown over the last 25 years is that what we might refer to as gender-affirming care lowers the rates of suicidality amongst these young people and teens by something like a margin of like 65 to 70%. That's huge. Now, what does gender affirming care mean? If you listen to someone who is staunchly transphobic, they will tell you that this is like purely hormones and genital mutilation and so on and so forth. But if you actually read the literature, gender affirming care includes things like letting children wear clothing of their choice, affirming them in their gender identity, and in many ways celebrating and I don't want to necessarily say encouraging, but just affirming, right? We understand that this is the way that you want to live your life.
Well, it is sold as brainwashing and...
Exactly,
Okay, can I hold on? For anyone who doesn't know you, Jack, or doesn't listen to your show at night, and it is a very popular show, so I'm assuming that everyone does, but I don't want to make that assumption.
Sure.
You consider yourself a conservative, right?
Yeah, in many ways, yeah, because I like to think that people can live a healthy and free life without state oppression in many ways.
But you know what is so refreshing to me is that as a conservative, you are not buying into what so many conservatives do. And you just spoke a bunch of facts.
Yeah, well, because what most conservative commentators do is they listen to Tucker Carlson or Ben Shapiro or you name it. And then they regurgitate those talking points because that's what the cool kids are talking about, right? They're basically parroting right-wing media talking points, which are generally organized and funded by think tanks who are working for mega corporations to try to get you to think a certain way about politics. So, for instance, the Daily Wire, which is Ben Shapiro's company, is largely funded by a family that works in oil and fracking and not renewable resources. And so, surprise of surprises, Ben Shapiro does not think climate change is a real thing. He thinks that electric-powered vehicles are a fad, so on and so forth, right? So I think that people need to realize in many ways that their conservative identity is orchestrated by megacorporations and is in no way attached to something like a William F. Buckley-type thinker or, let us say, like a Thomas Sowell-type thinker,
right,
but is, again, largely like incepted based on the desires of specific mega corporations.
Okay, I want to get to Chef because he had an analogy that I thought was brilliant. Because again, going back to the question on pronouns, why do we care? Why is this not just being about being woke?
Well, Jack, I am a liberal, but I remember a couple years ago. I know, right? I remember a couple of years ago starting to see the pronouns pop up in the emails from Seattle City employees. And I remember just basically rolling my eyes at the time, like, oh, gosh, why are we doing this? This is clearly a political statement. I've come a long way from that point, and I do think that addressing people correctly is very important, and it's important to respect people. And here's why. I have a friend who has a child that they refer to as they.
I do too.
Yeah. And I realized, because every parent can identify with this, if you've ever had someone come up to your son who's a baby and say, oh my gosh, she's so cute. How old is she?
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, as a parent, there's something in your chest that viscerally just reacts, and you think, no, it's a boy. And you tell that person. Now imagine if every time that person saw your child, they said, oh my gosh, look at her. No, it's a boy, and they keep doing that. Or if you've had a girl with short hair, people have called a boy. Or you have a boy with long hair, and people refer her to as a girl, and you correct them. Now imagine them continuing to do that. Imagine how angry you would feel. That is how disrespected trans people feel when they are intentionally misgendered.
And that's a very easy way to explain, you know, something that we don't know, but that I love that analogy, and I appreciate that. Okay, coming up, what's new at 10? This is the G and Ursula Show.